activate the view screen, and turn on your universal translators, because it is time for another Galactic Netcast.
We interrupt this program to give you a bulletin just received from one of our naval units at sea. A large object traveling at supersonic speed is headed over the North Atlantic toward the east coast of the United States.
This Earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder.
This could be the beginning of the end for the human race. Human beings cower before the onslaught of these unearthly enemies.
It is Thursday, October 31st, 2013, and welcome to another Galactic Netcast. This is the Alien Invasion number 88 from Waterloo, Iowa. I'm Dave Chucky Nelson. Joining me this evening from Wausau, Wisconsin is Brad, Michael Ludwig, and Anessa Carey Moyens from Denton, Texas. Happy Halloween, guys.
Happy Halloween.
Happy
to
Halloween.
You, Dave.
In hindsight, I probably should have done like what they actually say, so Chucky would have been like, I'll be your friend till the end. Although Michael doesn't really say anything.
No, he just has a mask.
So.
Brad's got a mask.
He does have a mask.
Say something, Brad.
Something, Brad. And I'm witty, too.
What's that made out of?
It's made out of brass.
Wow, that's some hardy stuff right there.
Yep. It's a my costume is a steampunkified version of Dr. Doom. Baron von Doom PhD, huh? Does that sound steampunky or what?
That's okay. Awesome.
Did you actually wear that today?
Did I wear the costume to work?
No, did you wear the mask?
Well, the mask is like it's like got a masquerade. I soldered a brass rod to it.
Oh, I see.
So I can hold it up.
Okay. And this is another reason why you guys should be watching us live or on YouTube, youtube.com/galacticnetcasts. You get to see the awesome. Did you make that yourself?
Yeah. I found a pattern that somebody made a Dr. Doom mask out of cardboard, and I went, cardboard? And then I decided to make it out of brass. And after 4 hours of working with metal that I have never worked with before and using a soldering torch, which I almost burned my curtains. I got the project not to where I wanted it to be, but at least this is sort of a proof of concept and done to the point where it got to be about midnight when I finished this up. And I decided that the later it got, the more bad decisions I would be making, and I would probably burn my house down. So I went, eh. And then I just soldered this rod on the back, and I'm like, yep. That would be like a masquerade-type mask now. Done. And then I went to bed.
Yeah, nothing good ever happens after midnight, so that was probably that was a wise decision. All right,
yeah,
so...
Scorched my curtains, so that was kind of cool.
But hey, you know, the mask looks good. Who cares if you burn down your house? The mask looks good.
Yeah.
All right, well, happy Halloween, everybody. And let's get on with the show. This is the podcast where we talk about aliens and nothing but aliens and where we find them in all different areas, all different types of things in our society, like film, TV, video games, comic books, science, and in real life. And when I say aliens, for the new people, I'm talking extraterrestrial aliens, not the illegal kind, just to clarify. The show is divided into three sections: the news, the creature feature, our spotlight of a certain kind of alien, and our picks for the week. I wonder if anybody ever thought that this was a podcast about illegal aliens.
Although technically they are not U.S. citizens, so they would be illegal.
They would
aliens.
Be illegal aliens.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
Actually, like, when I ventured on this recast oh so long ago and saw that the alien invasion was going on, I briefly wondered if maybe it was
a bunch of rednecks from Wisconsin going, ah, them foreigners crossing the borders and taking our stuff.
The icon showed extraterrestrials. I'm like, oh, cool. Like, this is probably something I'll listen to. But I'm like, wait, what if they're talking about immigration issues?
No.
And so I went ahead and I clicked the button, and now here I am.
Wow. That's what a great story, though. I mean, look where you are. Look what you got out of the deal.
I know. Thank you for not talking about immigration.
You got a spot on a show and a boyfriend.
Yeah.
I did. It was like the best decision ever.
Yeah, me and Brad and I were this close to actually talking about illegal aliens. We thought, you know.
What?
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Because I must have missed that meeting.
Before we get underway officially, I need to first, number one, apologize to our subscribers, our podcast subscribers. We had a technical issue last week. Where we host our audio is archive.org, and they changed the way they create their URL. So they were creating HTTPS URLs, and it wasn't iTunes and other podcast services. They don't like HTTPS. So I didn't realize it until we were already like a week late getting our last podcast out. So we got it figured out. I had to go through that freaking site and just look at every little thing to figure out how the hell I was going to post these podcasts. Our apologies to the subscribers to the podcast. Hopefully that will not happen again. So with that, we can start the podcast. So let's begin with this.
In the news.
And Anessa.
Deja vu. So apparently, alien spaceships, giant alien spaceships, are heading for Earth again.
Okay, wait a second, Anessa. When you say giant, how big is giant?
Like, giant. Actually, I don't know. As big as a base star.
I was going to ask you I was going to use the base star. That's a Galactica reference.
Yes.
Wow. Yes. That's pretty good. It's very good. I was going to say Death Star, but base star is really good too.
I like Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
So apparently these are actually huge. The largest one of the three giant spaceships is 200 miles wide.
Holy shnikes.
So it's from DFW down to probably about Austin or a bit further. So, yeah, it's huge. I don't think base stars were quite that big. But then I don't really know.
Yeah, they never really said. They never really specified.
Yeah, they never specified the size that I'm aware of. So the two others that are traveling with this behemoth of a spaceship are slightly smaller, but they don't say how much slightly is. So maybe they're 150 miles wide. But at present, the objects are just moving past Jupiter. And judging by their speed, they should be by Earth by October, which Dave got on to me earlier for complaining a little bit about the story. So, three similar giant ships landed in China and Indonesian Sea in November 2011, and they were identified as alien spaceships from the planet Guten.
Yay!
We actually talked about that, didn't we, Dave?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Way back when.
This is
way
been,
back when.
This, you know, like this is the one. Vu. This is the one constant of this podcast. I think are the Gutens, and then later on the Z-bombs.
Yep.
The Guten showed up first, and they've been. This is the slowest invasion in the history of the galaxy.
And apparently, repeated invasion because didn't they just get here not too long ago, and then we talked them out of invading Earth, and so they went and wreaked havoc somewhere else.
That's
and now
right.
Apparently they're coming back.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Okay, when you first...
Yeah, because Obama saved them from destroying Earth on the 4th of July, because apparently the entire planet Earth celebrates.
So they must have changed
the Independence
their...
Day. Of
yeah, they must have changed their mind and came back. They're like, you know what? Second thought, I don't think we
so
like...
We're already here, so let's just go back. Andromeda, it's just too far. We'll just turn around. We'll go back. It'll be fine. We'll take the scenic route this time.
So how did we find out that these ships were out there?
Well, the new Guten spaceships, because apparently these are also Guten spaceships, have been detected by HARP Research System. The system, based in Alaska, was designed to study the phenomenon of northern lights. According to SETI researchers, the objects are extraterrestrial spaceships. They will be visible in optical telescopes as soon as they reach Mars's orbit sometime in October. So they should be visible. If you happen to have a telescope, look towards Mars, and maybe you'll see these three Guten spaceships. They're big enough, I would imagine. 200 miles wide.
Are you going to go to the... are you going to go down to your... Because you have a telescope, right? You have the...
I don't have a telescope, but...
Oh.
The university I work
for. Yeah, I was going to ask you, are you going to go to the university's telescope and see if you can see these ships?
Going to see, well, one, if Mars is visible right now, and two, if I can find the Guten spaceships.
All right.
Yeah, but, I think Mars is visible right now. I think I remember seeing
Jupiter
it.
Jupiter is.
Maybe it's Jupiter I'm seeing. It seemed brighter than Jupiter, though. Huh.
I don't know. Jupiter's pretty bright right now, though.
Okay. That must be Jupiter, then.
Excuse me. Although Mars is slightly tinted red, like a orangish-colored dot in the sky. So, yeah. And the U.S. government is aware of the event. And SETI researchers have spent 50 years monitoring space. And Dr. Malley said that they have conclusively proven that we are just welcome newcomers in this huge and unexplored world. That's weird. That's a weird sentence. Many believe that there are many other civilizations in space besides our own civilization. So yeah, it's crazy. Like, the Gutens are coming. The Gutens are coming. And they're going to be illegal aliens, and so now we have to talk about, like, immigration issues from space.
That's a really interesting subject approach. What's the legality? You know, if they kind of covered that on District 9, right? Kind of, sort of. Right?
Yeah, they kind of. They stuck them in District 9, and they're like, we don't want to fool with them.
Yeah.
They're not really welcome here.
Yeah, they didn't really treat them too well, did they?
No, they were awful to the poor aliens in District 9. So, that really is an interesting issue if aliens were to ever, from outer space, come to Earth and want to live here. Like, how do we work them into our existing system?
Yeah.
And
actually, we've got a story coming up about meeting alien races and how that would all work.
That's right. Yeah, I did look ahead at that story. So maybe we should table that discussion for now.
Maybe.
Yes.
And Dr. Malley said that a Chinese official, Mao Khan, has obtained over 1,000 secret NASA photographs depicting not only human footprints, but even a human carcass on the surface of the moon.
What?
Because apparently WikiLeaks also released many classified documents that talks about the Guten spaceships coming, and apparently they also caught some images of human bones on the moon. Who knows?
Hmm.
Yeah, so maybe the Gutens, when they were here the first time, they abducted a couple of people and then just left them on the moon.
Didn't take them.
I don't really know. The Gutens are weird.
It didn't take them very long to be done with the humans.
They're like, I don't like this one. But
they were too chatty, and they kicked them out the door.
Yes.
Where are we going?
They're like, are we there yet? Are we there yet?
There's a rest stop right out here. Just get out, and we'll wait for you. Promise.
It's like, I saw the American astronaut. Is there really a bar on Ceres? No. Out you go.
Oh, hey, speaking of the American astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
It's Halloween, you know what we should do? We should have a party.
It's fun when you get started.
Oh, no!
To let the listeners know, I actually created a real soundboard online that you can go to. And we'll put the URL. This is a public soundboard. We'll put the URL in the show notes. And you can listen to our sound effects to your heart's content. Until Brad gets done.
And whack off from your rectum.
Oh, it's Halloween. All right. I'm done. Shall we move on, or do you want to talk more about this?
Oh, yeah. So aliens coming to Earth, invading Earth in December of this year.
Or October.
Well, that's the thing that kind of bugged me about the story.
Well, they better hurry up.
They should be on Earth by October 2013, but then it says they should be by Jupiter by this time, 2013. And I was like, which is it? But then apparently the actual invasion is going to take place in December, which makes sense considering the Gutens tend to wait forever and a day to invade once they get here. They just kind of drop their goo.
And I'm guessing that
rain is, animals.
And I'm guessing that
you turned into Andrew Dice Clay for a second there.
Oh.
Something's going to happen to make this invasion slow down or stop completely. Something. I'm guessing that they're not actually going to invade in December.
But
no, because they're going to realize that it's Onesimus is celebrated that month, and they're like, "Oh, we can't invade in December.
Oh.
We'll wait."
I forgot about Onesimus. Onesimus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Celebrated by Gutens.
All right. Here we go. Story number two. Star Wars Episode 7, struggling to make the 2015 release date. Disney CEO won't allow delay to 2016. So they're going to release this thing no matter what. Are you guys nervous about that?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, it seems like it could be a half-assed product in 2015 then.
Yeah. Okay, here's the story. There's been a good deal of rumor-mongering about the release of Star Wars Episode 7, with claims that the seventh installment of the sci-fi space opera Juggernaut will launch in either November 2015 or December 2015, in spite of Disney's continued assurances that a spring-summer 2015 premiere remains the target date. Oh, Brad is showing something on his screen. Hang on.
Episode 7, insert title here.
That is awesome. I was actually just thinking about that. If that's been discussed yet, the subtitle, the Episode 7 Attack of the Mars People or whatever is going to be. Oh. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the dealio is there.
Sorry, I was drinking tea.
No drinking during the show.
Thirsty.
Tell that to Matt.
I'm out in the sun for
yeah, that's true.
Ever.
All right, so today we have some additional fuel to that fire in the form of another story that raises doubt about when the movie will hit theaters. Such news sounds rounds out a tough week of speculation and unconfirmed reports about the development process on Episode 7. After the story from a few days ago that suggested Disney and Lucasfilm have been forced to get the ball rolling on the fifth Indiana Jones movie. Man, people, slow down there.
Why are they making another Indiana Jones movie?
Because they make money off those.
Money!
Yeah.
There's only three.
They spent a lot of money to buy Lucasfilm, so they're probably looking to grab all of the franchises they can and fling out as much stuff to make their money back.
Well, don't forget, Brad, we've got six Star Wars movies ahead of us. You got your episode 6, 7, and 8, then the character stories.
Yep.
You don't seem too happy about that.
Nope.
Do you want to talk about it?
Not particularly. I think the episodes 4, 5, and 6, of course, the original releases, pretty darn good. 1, 2, and 3, wow. No thank you. Mm-hmm. I saw 1 and 2, and I refuse to give anybody my money to see the third one, even though people keep telling me, oh, it's the best of the bunch. I'm like, Lucas pooped in my mouth the first two. I'm not letting him do it again. And
fool me once, shame on you.
I got fooled twice.
Yeah.
And I'm not doing it again. And wow, 6, 7, 8? I don't think so. I really don't. Okay. Or 7, 8, 9, sorry.
Okay, several insiders who are reported as being close to the project and are now bringing in word that new Lucasfilm president and Episode 7 executive producer Kathleen Kennedy, along with most of the film's creative team, have asked Disney to push the release date back to 2016. However, Disney CEO Robert Iger, is it Iger?
Yes.
Or Iger. Iger? Okay. He's refusing to budge on the 2015 date, while director J.J. Abrams is apparently in sync with Iger's desire, even though, as a result,
bye. Oh, sorry.
He's had to step in and contribute to the screenwriting process. I read that earlier this week, that J.J. is actually writing the story now, or writing the screenplay. Ironically, it was originally Abrams who was supposedly not committed to a 2015 release date for Episode 7, which started the rumors about the delay to 2016 in the first place. So he was the catalyst for the rumors of the pushback, but now he's in with this Robert Iger guy. Interesting.
I wonder if they slipped them some more cash and said, hey, let's make sure we hit this date.
It's possible.
Yeah, no, I think J.J. Abrams is best under pressure. They were dragging their feet on writing the script for the latest Star Trek movie. And once it got done, that's when the ball started rolling. Like, they full speed ahead. They went into production, bam, 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 they got it in. And they got it out late.
That's what she said?
Is that officially the first "that's what she said" of this episode?
No.
No, we were...
I beat her to the punch earlier.
Oh, okay. Because I know we were doing it a lot in pre-show.
No, maybe it was pre-show. I don't remember. To people who are listening, just roll this back and you can double check if you really care enough.
Okay, moving on with the story.
Moving on.
Many of the site's insiders say that the script isn't close to ready, and that is why Abrams is now working on the screenplay with Episode 7 consultant and Empire Strikes Back Return of the Jedi screenwriter Lawrence Kasdan. The problem of studio executives setting a tentpole's release date well ahead of the production getting started, forcing the project to move down the pipeline faster than preferable, is one that we've heard about more and more frequently in recent years because it's all about money. That's why. They want to get them out, get the movies out. They don't care about the creative end of it. They just want to make money. So I think that if this movie does fail, I think it's going to be because of that. It's going to be greedy studios.
What? That never happens.
No.
Hey, it's not so.
No. So we'll see. I think this movie, though, when it does actually go into production, if JJ is directing it, it's going to be good. The story's got to be good, though, for it to be a good movie.
Well, people said that about Superman Returns with Singer in the director's chair, so I don't know. Superman Returns was not that good. Kevin Spacey was awesome, but...
Yep.
I haven't seen Superman Returns.
That's okay.
Yeah, just skip right over it.
I own it, and when you come to visit, then maybe you can watch it by yourself, and I'll stick my head in a snowbank.
How about after I move up there? Because I'm sure it'll be a bit before I find a job. So that'll be on the background while I'm applying for jobs.
There we go.
All right. Hey, do you guys want to say anything more about the story? Predictions? Your gut feeling about this?
I don't know. The rushing is... the point that they make with X-Men First Class, X-Men First Class was a pretty darn good film, I think. Although there are some people that would argue that some things about it weren't all that good, but all in all, it was pretty darn good. But rushing something through, especially such a beloved franchise like mm-hmm. Star Wars, I mean, granted, you're talking to an older guy here who loves 4, 5, and 6. And doesn't really care for 1, 2, 3. Younger audiences who were basically raised with 1, 2, 3 and then saw 4, 5, 6 and went, God, that's really dated and old. It's going to be interesting to see how well they handle, you know, doing these the next series of films and Are they going to be able to unify the two different diverse audiences and make this work? If they rush it, are they going to harm that possibility? It's going to be interesting to,
you know,
to see.
I really don't think the younger generation feels that way about episode 1, 2, and 3, to tell you the truth. I think they think they're bad, as bad as we do.
Huh.
That's my gut feeling. I could be wrong.
We should put a survey on our site.
Yeah, we could do that. Could definitely do that. Huh, maybe we will.
Could use Google Forms.
Yeah.
Bam.
Or we can use Strawpoll. Strawpoll.me, I believe.
Yeah. It's a really... Poll Daddy could also work too.
Yeah, Poll Daddy as well.
That sounds dirty.
Anessa, do you have anything to say about the story and not just something snide?
Not about a website that could be about somebody that making somebody pole dance for money.
We're talking aliens. We're talking aliens in film.
Trying to.
My bad.
Curse you, Mullins.
No, I've got nothing else to add to the story.
Okay. All right. Then in that case, let's move on and ask for your feedback. How's that sound?
Yes.
Good.
Anessa, how would people go about to give us feedback? How does that
telepathy
happen? Telepathy, okay. Sure.
Or if they don't have that ability, they can go to our website, contact.galacticnetcasts.com. They can email us at galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. They can call us, or they can send us a text at 805-328-3966. Data rates do apply if you send a text message. Or you can leave a comment in the forums at galacticnetcasts.com/community.
Were you just singing that? Data rates may apply?
A little bit.
Is that from something?
Nope.
Or you just made that
it
up?
It came from
yourself?
Her brain!
Okay.
I randomly sing things.
It's true.
Is there a reason why you do that, or it just happens?
Just happens.
Okay. All right. All right. Yeah. Please leave us feedback, positive or negative. Doesn't matter. We'll take it all. We love hearing from our listeners, our fans, our community. Community is what this is all about, and we want you to be as involved as we are in the making of this stuff. So thank you very much. All right. Mm-hmm. So, Brad, you've got the final story. What you got there, buddy?
So what you got?
Quit
something
interrupting.
Not by the Beastie Boys.
Quit interrupting, Anessa.
I'm sorry. It's
my turn.
Yeah, you had your story.
It's my turn. I have the talking stick now, so meh. That's what she said. All right. Alien life experts urge creation of guidelines for interacting with extraterrestrials. Does that sound familiar to anybody?
It sounds familiar from 10 minutes ago.
Well, there is that, but guidelines for contacting aliens.
Oh, I know this. I got this. This sounds like Star Trek, The Prime Directive.
It kind of does.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting that Roddenberry was way ahead of his time.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Let's get into the story. They're saying that humanity should start thinking about how to interact with alien species long before coming into contact with them, you know, planning ahead and stuff like that. So they're talking about coming up with a strict set of guidelines that govern the way people on future interstellar space missions study and interact with aliens. And it's kind of imperative before anyone blasts off to a distant world, according to these attendees at Starship Congress that happened in August. While a prime directive, the rule that prevented Starfleet officers from interfering with the business of alien life forms on TV Star Trek, might be a little extreme, such a rule could help govern interactions between aliens and humans. In the event that we discover evidence of intelligent life on another world, that would be a social, cultural, and technologically influential event to human affairs, which will need to be managed with great care and to ensure our culture and their culture remains intact and not disrupted by this new knowledge. Calvin Long, the founder of Project Icarus, said during a panel on August 16th. People traveling to distant stars will be carrying tangible and intangible aspects of human culture with them. So it should be curated responsibly before being sent to an alien planet, one expert said. I think it comes down to how we're going, Armin Papazarian, the CEO of International Space Development Hub, said. Do we trust that it is a beautiful universe, an incredible cosmos? Do we really believe that it's an amazing landscape, it's a bed of stars? What do we think we're going out there to find, and are we going to embrace it, or are we going to utilize? Are we trying to export our scarcity economics, or are we trying to enjoy the abundant cosmos? Whatever we are here, we're going to export wherever we go.
That's kind of an interesting concept to think about, because you have to kind of have a goal in mind before you get out there and start messing with things. You know?
Yeah.
You don't want what happened to the Old West when the white man decided to go west, and you know what happened with the Indians.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That needs to be considered very seriously. The other thing too, if you think about it, even on our own planet, American culture permeates so many others. You know,
mm-hmm.
Our music. This sounds like this statement's about to reek of pretentiousness and hubris, probably. But because we're more of a global economy, the internet has changed so much, and we are able to experience other people's cultures, and there's a lot of back and forth. So I think thinking about this ahead of time, so we're not, we've all seen the Star Trek episode where, Into Darkness, where Kirk makes the decision to pull the ship out of the water to save Spock. We know as the viewer, the Enterprise didn't know, none of the crew did, but we know as the viewers that they fundamentally rocked the world of those aliens that they ran into.
Yeah, because there was that last scene where they were
drawing the ship, and they were like, yep. that was a, to them, that was godly.
Oh, yeah.
They have no concept of interstellar travel. Nothing like that. And to see this huge ship come rising out of the water and taking off, obviously gods must have done that. So I really agree with the statement that we have a responsibility to think about these things ahead of time so that we don't leave something behind. He's talking about intangible intangible things, leaving something like that behind and totally shifting the development of a world just because we want to look at their pretty flowers or whatever.
And we also have to think about running into or interacting with a more advanced culture and the dangers that go along with that as well. We don't want to tell them too much about us because we have to prepare our society for what we learn by interacting with one of those advanced species.
Yeah. Because it will – I just even think about Christianity. I mean, we'll just look at one religion. The concept of – the whole structure and the tenets of people that really take the Bible 100% literally, finding another intelligent race would totally destroy their view of the Bible. If they take it as literal word of God that it is, what's in the Bible is that's it.
Yeah.
There's nothing outside of that. Finding an intelligent race outside of that would just – that would explode. And you would probably have religions splinter, people that want to keep that that core thought of the Bible completely intact, and others that would peel off and go, well, you know, maybe it means this instead. And it would fundamentally change a lot of things on Earth.
Yeah,
so,
the day that Earth finds out that there is intelligent life out in the galaxy is the day that a lot of people that are very deeply religious will, like,
they will question their core values.
And they might even, you know, kill themselves, you know, because they don't want to live.
Some might, yeah.
You know, they don't want to live without that religion that they grew up, that they, you know, based all their tenets on, their David tenets on. Sorry.
Alan Z. All right. It is possible that humans in the future will have no desire to land on exoplanets after free roaming in space for years at a time. Icarus Interstellar President Richard Obusi said, whew, that's an interesting name. I'm not convinced that when we have the capabilities to build starships that we'll want to go from one gravitational abyss to another gravitational abyss. I'm not convinced that settling on planets or even moons is going to be necessary. I think that's a little short-sighted.
Well, this comes from that
the Congress.
Yeah. These are the same people that are working on generation ships, how to go about making generation ships. So they want to go out into the galaxy and just start going.
Yeah, one other thing too, looking at our planet has finite resources, right? And I'm not even going to try to pull sci-fi movies into this. We're going to talk about science fact. I was listening to Neil deGrasse Tyson talk about larger space bodies that didn't have enough gravity to actually become a planet. So we've got free roaming, you know, planetoids or smaller hunks of rock in space. They didn't become planets, but because they are most likely very raw, there's going to be iron, there's going to be platinum, there's going to be dense metals in these asteroids. So there's going to be a time in the near future where we start mining some of those precious materials.
Planetary resources. That company was made to do that.
So the thought would then be, would we try to go to other planets and try to barter for their resources for our own purposes, or maybe even if it's a generational ship, if they want to resupply or something like that, what kind of contact and how would you structure that contact with another alien race? I think that would be another thing that we need to consider too.
My theory is it's going to be awfully difficult to communicate with any kind of alien race.
Yeah.
Just because you have no point of reference. You know, it's like that episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation, where Picard had to talk in metaphor, right?
Yes. I remember the first time I saw that episode, and I started bawling my fists and yelling at this. I'm like, "Ah, this is insane! You're never gonna figure this out." And of course, well, I, you know, they did figure it out.
Shaka, the walls fell.
Well, just listening to that guy talk just drove me insane too.
Yeah.
But the more I thought about it, I'm like, yeah, actually that does, you know, years later when I became a little bit not a teenager anymore, it really made a lot more sense.
A little bit not a teenager anymore? Does that mean that you're still a little bit teenager?
Yeah, probably a little bit.
Right.
I'm vaguely immature. But, you know, that does make a lot of sense. They're going to have an entirely different – you look at just foreign languages on our planet, the way – like water in French is O. That – I'm not sure – you know, when you try to look at English, the word is water. In French, it's O. How did they come up with that word?
Yeah.
And you think about an entirely different planet, something entirely separate.
With entirely different – things,
references,
yeah,
different types of flora, fauna, whatever, they're going to have an entirely different language that is going to be so alien to us that it's going to be very hard to figure out.
You're not going to be able to quote movies with them. It's going to be ridiculous.
No, it's going to be very, very difficult. Anyways, we're running really long on this story. So we're just going to pretty much – I think we're just going to wrap this up with a final thought with Les Johnson of the Tennessee Valley Interstellar Workshop. Says that his group has developed three moral principles that he hopes will serve as a guide for any interactions with all kinds of extraterrestrial life. The first one, learn all you can before risking any kind of direct interaction. Two, if it seems to be alive, leave it alone. Three, avoid bringing samples to the home world because it might not be totally incompatible with our ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was Anessa introduced me to the mesquite tree, and I didn't realize that the mesquite tree is a horribly invasive tree. And it got moved from one area to another, and it just totally took over. Could you imagine? You know, we're even looking at, like, what is it, the Everglades? They've got all sorts of snakes out there that are not indigenous, and there's nothing there to stop their growth. They actually hunt snakes that are growing out there because there's no top predator nothing was set in place for that ecosystem to keep them in check. And imagine bringing something that's entirely alien to our planet that might be able to survive in our ecosystem. There would be nothing we could really do to stop it.
Yep.
So it would be very difficult to. So he raises very, very good points here. So, we'll just end that there. So, Anessa, you've been really quiet about this. What do you think?
I've just been listening.
Okay.
Anessa, I'm sorry for telling you to shut up earlier.
That's cool.
I was just joking. I didn't mean it. I wasn't serious.
I don't really have anything to add to the story, though.
Okay. All right. Yeah, it's interesting. I think that we definitely need to have something in writing before we start messing around with other parts of the galaxy. It's a good idea. All right, so
a good set of guidelines. Absolutely.
Yes. Time for this.
And now it's time for Creature Feature.
All right, Brad. You're it. You're it. Time for the Creature Feature.
All right. We're sticking with a theme that Dave had asked me to stick with, and I'm cool with that. We're going to talk about an alien race in Marvel Comics called the Skrulls. And the Skrulls originate from the planet Skrullos and were originally a mercantile civilization primarily interested in free trade and willing to share their technology with all races they deemed worthy. When they encountered a new race, they simply transformed themselves to resemble that race. So they're a race of shapeshifters.
Ah.
The Skrull Empire that resulted from these contacts was based on free trade and mutual cooperation. The Empire is controlled by an emperor, and each of the 978 worlds is controlled by a governor. Skrulls are green-skinned reptilian humanoids with large pointy ears, red or green eyes, and chins with several vertical folds in the skin below their mouths. So they're kind of, you know what I'm saying.
Oh, I know what you're saying, Brad.
That was totally a visual thing, and for the people that aren't watching the YouTube video of that, I apologize.
Brad, before you continue... How accurate were the Skrulls on the Avengers as opposed to the Skrulls in the comic book?
The Skrulls haven't been in the Avengers.
Oh, I thought they were in.
No, that was the Chitauri.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay.
Yep.
Sorry. Go ahead.
The Skrulls are known for genetic and molecular instability and genetic diversity due to celestial experimentation creating the Skrull deviants. Now, the Celestials are a race of super advanced beings that could almost be viewed as gods because they are so far ahead technologically. They actually sort of engineered the Skrulls to a certain degree. The Skrulls are known for their physical malleability and ability to shapeshift to any size, shape, or color at will, taking on the appearance but not the characteristics of other beings and objects within a volume range of 0.75 to 1.5 times the Skrull's original volume. So they can change, but they can only change their mass so much.
Okay.
Skrulls are able to assume virtually any form, be it organic, example, a cow, or inorganic, a lamp. As a result, the Skrulls excel at spying and infiltration. Skrulls are also able to use their shape-shifting abilities to form weapons, example, like blades or clubs, so they could actually transform their arm into a club and hit somebody or a sword and attack with parts of their bodies, making them dangerous hand-to-hand combatants. Their sexual dimorphism is roughly the same as a human being, but their sexual orientation is more complex since they can change their genders at will. Indeed, it was once casually said that for a Skrull, changing gender is comparable to a human being changing their hair color. The Skrulls later developed the ability to render themselves undetectable when using their shape-shifting abilities, even from telepaths and those with superior senses. It is believed that Skrulls' eyes are incapable of subtle visual perceptions as those of Earth humans. For example, Skrulls once mistook samples of drawn artwork for photographs. So, the Skrulls are mostly a Fantastic Four villain, but they have appeared in other comics as well. They actually have engineered soldiers like the Skrull, the Super Skrull is the name of the particular character, and he can actually mimic the abilities of another superhero. So, like in the first meeting of the Super Skrull with the Fantastic Four, you could see that he was on the cover, he was partially invisible, and he had the Thing's arm, and he was sort of wrapping that Thing arm with the rocks around another, you know, one of the other Fantastic Four, and one of his other arms was on fire, and, you know, he was just mimicking all their abilities at the same time, which made him truly a unique warrior.
What was he introduced in the Fantastic Four?
Yes.
Okay. What year? Yeah. I have a follow-up question. What year? Do you know what year they were introduced?
No, but I'm sure the internet does. It would have been the 60s, but I don't know.
On a side note, PBS has this awesome documentary series about comics that you guys should check out. Or you in particular, Brad. I don't know if Vanessa would enjoy it as much. I watched.
Possibly.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Shouldn't judge. Sorry. I watched the first two parts are online. I think maybe they aired the third part this week, and it hasn't been put up on their website yet. But it's very interesting.
They were introduced actually in Fantastic Four number 2, which would have been January 1962.
Wow. Way, way back. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
All right.
So there you go.
Interesting. Yeah, right off the bat, they were introduced to the Fantastic Four almost.
Yep. So there you go. It's the Skrulls is our creature feature this week, and they are found in Marvel Comics.
Neat. All right. Thank you, Brad. Good job. All right. Picks time. Let's do the picks. I was in the mood. I had a hankering last night for Star Trek. So I listened to Star Trek I suppose you could listen to it. You are listening to it as you're watching it. But I watched Star Trek Enterprise Season 4, Episode 3, called Home. And this is the first episode after the Enterprise came back from the Expanse. Are you guys both familiar with the Enterprise show?
I am not.
Okay. Vanessa, no.
A little
Brad,
bit.
Yes. Okay. So they had to. They took a whole season doing one thing, exploring this region of space called the Expanse to look for these group of aliens that were targeting Earth. Some huge device that they were going to launch at Earth and it was going to blow it up. So they were looking for these people. So this is the episode when they got back from Earth. So they're all going on like leave, and they're all, and this episode was really much, very much about aliens discovering kind of fish out of water, like aliens not in their familiar environment, because Dr. Phlox took his leave on Earth, and the Earth has changed since this, because the Earth was attacked, but not like majorly, because the Enterprise stopped these aliens from attacking. So the people of Earth have a different attitude about aliens since this attack. So Phlox discovers some prejudice going on, some racism. He was actually attacked by humans on Earth. The other part of the story is Commander Tucker goes with T'Pol to Vulcan. So he's got to kind of navigate that whole Vulcan culture and meeting T'Pol's parents or T'Pol's mom. And then there's another a guy that T'Pol was promised to marry. So that's another storyline. And then there's a third storyline of Captain Archer and his relationship with this other captain, this female captain, Erica Hernandez, who is going to be the captain of the Columbia, which is the second starship that they were about to launch. So it's very much a non-typical Star Trek episode, because it's very much about people kind of relaxing, calming down, getting some R&R after a big, you know, serious mission. And it's also about adjusting to life back, normal, you know, quote-unquote normal life again. So I recommend it. It's season 4, episode 3. There was only 5 seasons of Enterprise, and it's called Home. By the way,
cool.
There is a initiative on Facebook. There's a Facebook page of this group that wants to have Netflix produce a 6th season of Star Trek Enterprise. I liked their page, so I get updates from them.
Have they had any luck?
Not
getting
yet.
At least a response from Netflix.
I don't know really. Don't really know. So that is my pick. Let's move on to Anessa.
My pick is the War of the Worlds rebroadcast. It was October 30th, 1938, when it actually broadcast for the first time. Of course, the book is by H.G. Wells, and it was broadcast, well, it was adapted for a radio show, and Howard, I think it's Howard, Howard pops in my head, but Howard Koch is one of the people that adapted it to actually work with radio. And there's been many different versions of War of the World done, like various movies and whatnot, but this is the one that I think really stands out in people's minds whenever they think of War of the Worlds, just because it created so much havoc whenever it was broadcast, because the broadcast, basically it's your alien invasion story, but it's done as a radio broadcast. It makes me think of a movie that I watched, and I think I recommended it on the show, called Without Warning, where it was done as an actual TV broadcast, and I'm sure they were probably inspired by War of the Worlds whenever they did that. But this was a radio broadcast. At the very beginning of the show, they did specify that I believe it was CBS.
Yeah.
It was that CBS. aired, yeah, it was the Columbia Broadcasting System that aired this. And they made a note that, hey, this is a CBS radio show. It's an adaptation of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. And they mentioned that it was done by the Mercury Theater. And they're like, all right, let's do this. And so you had the intro of the show, and then you had Orson Welles talking about how they were going to, I forget which studio, where they had this band playing music. And so you go to this band, and they're playing music, and it, you know, it's nice. And partway through, you get like an announcement, or actually, I think before that, they actually kind of talk about the weather a little bit, and there's like this atmospheric disturbance. And then they go to the music, and so you're listening to the music, and then you get an interruption, and they talk a little bit more about just expected rain, that sort of thing, and then it goes back to the music, and then they start getting reports of like a meteorite, or they see like a flash across the sky, and so they send out one of their reporters to go investigate it in New Jersey at a farm, and they end up meeting up with this professor that goes and investigates the meteorite that supposedly hit Earth, and they find that it's a cylindrical object that's not actually a meteorite, and they find out that it's an actual vessel, and it starts to open up, and it starts killing people. And so you hear the panic in the background, and you hear people freaking out, and so you just kind of assume that everyone on this farm has died. Because initially, you know, you have a crowd of people going to check things out, and then things start happening, and they're like, oh, they're not having any problem getting these people to back away. And then all of a sudden you just hear people screaming and running and
okay, speaking
whatnot.
Speaking of screaming, did it sound something like this?
That might have predated Wilhelm, I believe.
Or this? Okay.
Probably closer to the Wilhelm.
All right. Okay. Continue.
So, but yeah, and you start going, and they kind of cut back and forth between the two, and eventually they just give up on the music altogether. And then, you know, they have word in from, like, the astronomical societies and different scientists sending messages and whatnot. And it's not until about maybe 40 minutes, 35, 40 minutes in, that they have a very brief intermission, and then that's when they remind everybody again that it's just a broadcast, like it's just a show. And usually I'm used to intermissions being about halfway through something and not so late into the broadcast. And I think that was probably part of the problem with the panic, because I figure people probably running late, didn't get to the radio in time to turn it on and listen to the show, didn't catch the disclaimer at the beginning going, hey, this is a production of the Mercury Theater, presented by the Columbia Broadcasting Company and all that good stuff. And so there was a lot of panic that ensued because of this. And it's after the intermission that it actually focuses on a central character, which is the professor that initially went out to the farm to investigate this object that had fallen to Earth. And it basically becomes a first-person point of view at that point, because he's talking about his encounters with another human survivor and that human survivor's theory on everything and how he thinks humans are going to become basically cattle and food for these aliens. And he tries to recruit the professor to help save mankind, because it's the scientists and the creative minds that's going to save humanity. And the people that are perfectly content with their daily routines and, you know, don't really care about doing anything else beyond their set routine are the ones that are going to be basically doing really well as cattle for these aliens. And so the professor's, you know, basically talking about how he's writing this all in his journal. And so, yeah, it's really good. I highly recommend it. It is kind of chilling, especially right before the intermission, just the way everything kind of wraps up for the live radio broadcast portion anyway, the reenactment of a live radio broadcast. And then the rest, like I said, is basically from the professor's perspective, because he's basically telling a story at that point.
And Orson Welles' delivery, his tone of his voice, is just so haunting, too.
It really is. I think he does a brilliant job. Yeah. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. And even if you listen to it not on Halloween, it's definitely a recommend. So,
yeah, this it freaked people out enough that Orson Welles had to apologize.
Yeah, and I mean, they did say that it wasn't a broadcast, but I do think that the intermission was really late in the series. Because, like I said, it wasn't until after the intermission that it's clearly a show at that point, but mm-hmm. they do it in such a way that listening to the radio then, like, this could have seemed legit. Yeah, it's the Southern California Public Radio is where I listen to it off of, and it has an introduction by George Takei that talks a little bit about it very briefly before they actually go into the broadcast. So if you have about an hour to spend, I highly recommend giving it a listen.
What did George Takei say?
Just that it's awesome. No, he talked about just basically what I've said. You know, it's like this production that's celebrating its 75th anniversary of the broadcast. And he makes mention of Orson Welles, and he makes mention of, like, the chaos that it created. And he talks a bit about who, like, the people that put it together and the adaptation, basically like what you would read about in Wikipedia, I guess. And then he also talks about the documentary that you can listen to as well. It's listed on the same page, if I remember correctly. And I think that's probably about 45 minutes in length, and I just didn't have time yesterday to listen
neat.
To it. But I think it would be really interesting to actually give a listen.
Yeah, totally.
And if you go to the website, the scpr.org, and we'll include the link in the show notes, but they have different YouTube videos, and I think they might have the Orson Welles apology, like the little press conference. It's like, sorry, my bad, where he gives his mea culpa. So, yep.
All right. Thanks, Inessa. War of the Worlds, radio broadcast. Good stuff. And Brad, we almost had the same pick this week because I was this close to watching Pod People last night.
Oof.
Dodged
I took
bullet
the bullet for you, dude. Okay. I really did.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's MST3K, so, I mean, it's a bad movie, but they make it fun. So tell us about it. That's your pick.
God, it was horrible. It was a terrible, terrible movie. I mean, of course, and this is like, this is Joel. So this is, you know, earlier on in the MST3K series. So it's Joel and the robots having to sit through Pod People. And the Pod People is a epically dreadful sci-fi film. And it is a... And they make the point, the MST3K cast make the point that it's like three films that kind of got shoehorned into one. You have a storyline of an alien that crash lands on Earth. You have the storyline of some poachers that are in the woods. And you've got a story about a group of friends that are recording an LP of really horrible music that we get exposed to repeatedly. And all three of these themes meet up at a certain point, and it just takes forever to get there. Oh, dear God in heaven. It was dreadful. But thank God Joel and the rest of the crew there were able to make fun of it and actually make it somewhat palatable.
What was the interstitial stuff between the movie? What were they doing? What was the storyline?
They were mocking the film. I mean, that's what they normally do. But I mean, they always do the invention exchange at the beginning of the show, and Joel created a new chord that took two hands to do, and then Crow strum, and he had like a keytar, not a keytar. It was a synthesizer that had the buttons for the chords, but it actually had like a motion sensing plate.
Mm-hmm.
That you could strum your fingers across, and that would activate basically strumming the strings. And Crow used his nose to brush past it, and the whole thing frickin' explodes. And then Frank and the doctor had made a karaoke machine that was filled with royalty-free music. So it had like Ave Maria. And it was a Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, and just, you know, stuff you would not karaoke to. It was pretty funny. But the whole thing was epically mocking the movie. The New Age music, they had a scene where Joel creates a wall of synthesizers, and he's working on teaching Crow. Crow's like, I don't know how to play the synthesizer. And Joel's like, you don't need to. Here, push here and here. And he makes a New Age chord, and they're like, yep, we're going to outsell Yanni. So, I mean, some of the references are dated because this was done in 91. The Pod People movie was done in 1990, so this was kind of freshly minted sci-fi garbage.
Oh, wow, it's that new. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Okay. It really feels like it's from the 70s, but it was done in the 90s. It just – oh. Is terrible. The alien looks like it's mammalian, but it is hatched from an egg. It grows pretty rapidly, and they don't explain anything really about the alien. You're kind of left with the impression that an adult alien had these eggs. Whether that creature laid the eggs or had the eggs, you're not clear on. But this child manages to grab one of the eggs and take it home, and he's got like a whole collection of woodland creatures. He's got a bunny rabbit and a kitten and all sorts of stuff, and now he's got a new thing that he's going to hatch. But obviously the adult version of the alien is very upset that its egg is gone. The last surviving egg out of this grouping of eggs that it had, and it is looking for its young. And so it starts killing adults because the adults keep trying to get into its way. And like we mentioned earlier, just from a communication standpoint, everybody's freaked out because they see an alien and this thing's really trying to just get its child back. So it's just it has an interesting theme, but it is so wretchedly executed that it is just a horrible – I mean literally if you have an hour and a half of your life where it's like, oh, I could stick my head in a bucket of icy water repeatedly or watch this film – you know, I would just fast forward through all the parts where you see the movie and just listen to Joel and the robots mock the movie, because that's the only really redeeming part of this whole fiasco. So, I mean, I've watched MST3K before where I've seen movies that are somewhat enjoyable, and, you know, Joel and the robots or Mike and the robots later on mocking the film just makes it that much better, but mm-hmm. This film was just miserable to watch.
It was carp.
It was complete and utter carp.
Carp. Okay. Hey, did you guys ever, well, I'm talking to Brad, I think Anessa, you maybe, I don't know, maybe you caught it too, but back in the day when you were younger, did you and your friends sit around and do MST3K style commentary on movies?
Oh, yes. I still do.
I was going to say, like, we do that at parties.
Yeah.
We'll just have, like, a really crappy movie playing in the background, and inevitably we just start talking crap about it and poking
fun. That's the beauty of MST3K. It's like, these guys did these so simple, it's brilliant. We all kind of do it anyway, and they took it to a new level of having actual – like Michael Nelson, who's Mike – becomes Mike later on in the show, was the head writer for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And he was – you know, he was writing a lot of the jokes, and it was kind of a collaborative effort. But, I mean, having actual really good comedic writers – create the lines and all the lampooning of the film took it to a new level. But it's something that I think we all do when we watch a really bad film. We want to just inject something to take away some of the misery of watching that piece of crap.
And those guys are still at it with their riff tracks.
Riff tracks.
Yeah.
Which is genius too, because normally you wouldn't be able to do that because you're using other people's works. You know, it's copyright infringement, but they just sell the tracks and you just play it along with the movie.
And yeah, you just, okay, this is where you start it, go.
Yep.
Because we did that, the physics club or society of physics, whatever, SPS, they were holding a fundraiser. And what they did, and this was back in probably 2008-ish, but they would play movies out at the observatory. So we would have a screen outside with the projector and the movie projected onto the screen, and you're sitting between these two domes, and we'd have like a telescope set up and they can use that. But people would come out, and we would just basically sell, or they would sell like the stuff in the concession stand because we can't charge for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did was on one of the movies, I don't remember which one it was, they just... like, hey, we're going to do the riff tracks, and they just played that with the movie, and people really enjoyed it.
That's cool.
So, yeah.
Awesome.
And I think that's pretty awesome. It's a good idea.
All right. So, in review, our recommendations, our picks were MST3K, Mystery Science Theater 3000 Pod People, War of the Worlds radio broadcast, and Star Trek Enterprise Season 4, Episode 3, Home. And we will have links to all of these in the podcast that you can then check out and sometimes even buy through our Amazon portal at galacticnetcasts.com. All right, that's going to do it. We would love for you to subscribe to us, URSS. Did I just say, I think I just made up a new word, URSS, URSS. Subscribe to us at... galacticnetcast.com/contact subscribe. You can find us on iTunes. And while you're on iTunes, make sure that you give us 5 stars and a good review or a good rating review if you want. And we're also on Stitcher, of course, and all other podcasting platforms. So subscribe today. We appreciate it, and we appreciate you listening. So feedback, 805-328-3966 is the voicemail number. Or you can email galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. All right, final thoughts before we leave. Brad.
Thor, next week. Looking forward to it. I don't think I'll get to see it before the next episode, but I think it'll be my pick for the following week.
My pick for probably not this show, but for Time Traveling Robots in Space next week is going to be... Ender's Game.
Nice.
I suppose it could be for this one, too, because there are aliens involved.
Oh, yes.
But it's mainly space, so probably space. Probably time-traveling robots in space next week.
And the reason why I keep bringing that up is, technically, we see that the Dark Elves have a ship.
You just
the
lost
Dark
me.
Elves are... I'm sorry, there's the 9 realms that we learn about in the first Thor movie. And this actually, Thor is kind of a – Thor 2 actually is an offshoot of the Avengers. Odin broke certain rules getting Thor to Earth to get the cube.
Mm-hmm.
And those rules that are broken for traveling the nine realms, the different planets, has very serious repercussions for the Earth. So, and we see that the elves actually travel in a spaceship.
Oh, cool.
Sorts. Awesome. Yes.
All right. Looking forward to your review after you see it.
Oh, yes.
And Anessa, final thought.
If I ever hit the lotto, I'm totally going to open up a Whataburger.
All right. Random but good. Thank you.
Add Whataburger for dinner.
Oh, okay. Something that we're not used to seeing in these parts, in this Midwest area.
Exactly. Because I figure if I hit the lotto, of course I'm going to be up north, and there's totally going to be Whataburger in Wisconsin then.
Cool.
I'm wondering if I should wear a bow tie to every episode from now on.
You should.
Bow ties are awesome.
They're cool.
Well, I guess technically cool, but they're awesome.
All right. With that, let's get out of here.
Just, you can skip the fez, though.
Yeah, no fans.
All right. With that, let's get out of here. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Leave your hailing frequencies open and scanners on full, because another Galactic Netcast will be approaching your coordinates soon. For more information, go to galacticnetcasts.com.